As we often do on Please Explain, we're going to look into a subject with its own inherent politics and controversies by taking a step back to consider the basics. Birth control, the various methods and how they work is our topic for today. And I'm joined now by Dr. Rini Banerjee Rattan, Assistant Clinical Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. I don't know why I had a problem with obstetrics. It's a perfectly fine word, isn't it?
Yes.
Maybe we should begin by talking about the cycle of fertility and how pregnancy works. Maybe that will help us understand how all the contraceptives work.
Sure. So if we think about the menstrual cycle, it's divided in two halves. The first half is when the egg develops. So the ovary is naturally filled with many, many eggs. And each month, one egg is recruited, so to speak, to be the dominant follicle. And over the first half of the cycle, the egg matures and then is released into the fallopian tube at the event called ovulation. The second half of the...
Now, how does it that determine which egg it's going to be? It's not necessarily the healthiest egg.
No, it isn't.
It's just one egg happens to be at the front of the line?
Kind of. Exactly. And in the second half of the cycle, it depends really what happened as a result of ovulation. So if the sperm and egg meet and are fertilized and pregnancy occurs or conception occurs, then obviously the pregnancy continues. And there is no second half of the menstrual cycle. If that event does not occur, then the lining of the uterus, which was being built up and in preparation for pregnancy to occur, is then triggered to essentially break down and
bleed. That's the endometrium.
That's the endometrium, correct.
And that women who have endometriosis have that lining keeps on coming off to a point where it's a serious problem.
The women of endometriosis have that, the tissue type or the cells that are in the lining of the uterus in different places. So places that they ought not to be in the abdomen.
So when we talk about most of the forms of birth control today, other than the barrier forms of birth control, we're talking about things, hormones or chemicals, I'm not exactly sure what words I should use, that somehow interrupt this process or change this process?
Many of the hormonal methods do act in a manner to either suppress ovulation or disrupt some of that that cycle at some point in the cycle.
Now is this something that has been known by humans for a long time?
Well, I think if you look back at the historical types of contraceptions that have been used, the oldest type of contraception, aside, of course, from abstinence, was probably withdrawal. So it was probably recognized early on that there was something contained in the seminal fluid that was necessary to have conception. So withdrawal was probably the oldest method. Then as time developed, people realized again that because there was something in this seminal fluid or in the semen, and that barrier methods might be more effective. So I think if you look back historically, there are accounts of women in ancient Egypt using pessaries that had acidic substances, some report crocodile dung and whatnot, to probably, had some type of a spermicidal effect. And then
this is almost like an earlier version of the diaphragm.
Correct.
Or the IUD.
More similar, more akin to the diaphragm. And also along those lines in early in Asia as well as in Europe, women probably used similar types of barrier methods, whether it was a beeswax or oil type paper, again, as a barrier method. It wasn't really until the 20th century when we recognized that there was a menstrual cycle and that ovulation occurs only once a month that any type of attempt to interrupt the menstrual cycle, whether it be hormonally or by periodic abstinence were effective.
Well, in all of this, we're talking about things that women have to do. The exceptions are condoms, vasectomy, I guess withdrawal. Beyond that, it's always the women. And this goes back historically to the very beginnings of contraception?
It does. Again, the
is it because it's easier with women, or is it because of the way societies have been structured?
I think it's probably both. I think historically, there was this notion that procreation was a necessary or a desirable event, and it was largely determined by a patriarchal society in many times. And so withdrawal was a method that was in the control of the man. It was about in the 17th century that the condom, the male condom, was first introduced. It was initially a piece of animal intestine, and my understanding is that it was not very popular, nor very effective, but it was an attempt not only to prevent pregnancy in certain instances, but also to prevent the transmission of syphilis.
When did the rhythm method come into the picture?
Again, the rhythm method came into practice really in the 20th century, once we had a better understanding of the menstrual cycle.
So let's talk about the various hormonal methods, beginning with the pill. Years ago, Carl Gerassi came here, and he talked about working in Mexico City and realizing that the Mexican yam had certain molecular similarities to, I guess it was estrogen.
Yes.
And that was the beginning of the development of the pill. Is that really it? I mean, was there nothing before?
Nothing really that, again, sort of from the hormonal perspective. There are some accounts in, the 1900s of IUDs or intrauterine devices. But again, hormonally, that really was the advent.
So is it odd that a Mexican yam would be similar to a basic part of the female chemical makeup?
Well, I think
well,
now,
I guess men also have estrogen, don't they?
I think now that we understand more about phytoestrogens and the similarities that many plant estrogens have, in retrospect, isn't that unusual, but certainly at the time it was incredibly novel.
So how does it work?
Well, the way the traditional pill that we think of, which is a combination pill, which contains both estrogen and progesterone, it has a number of mechanisms. It primarily acts by suppressing ovulation, and it also alters the mucus of the cervix, which makes it, an inhospitable environment to sperm. And it also makes the endometrium, as we were discussing earlier, or the lining of the uterus, thin.
Why does it suppress ovulation?
Well, again, what happens is in the normal menstrual cycle, there is a surge that occurs after the dominant follicle is recruited, and hormones that are in the pill essentially suppress that surge.
My guest is Dr. Rini Ratan, Assistant Clinical Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. We're talking about birth control today on Please Explain, and later we will be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Dr. John Rock, who developed, I guess, the pill itself, was a Catholic, and he thought that it would satisfy the concerns of the Catholic Church. Why was he wrong about that? Do you know?
Well, I think there are differing opinions in terms of how people individually view it, and as well as from the, I guess, higher members in the clergy in terms of what they feel is acceptable or not.
Well, he felt that this was starting at a very early stage. Some of the other methods have come along, stopped the whole process later on, and you can understand why Catholics, at least, would consider them unacceptable. But let's talk about some of the other ones. Well, first of all, is the birth control pill the most effective method of birth control, the most fail-safe?
Well, probably not, in the sense that all methods of birth control have what we consider a perfect use efficacy rate, as well as a typical use efficacy rate. And if you look at the perfect use efficacy rate for the pill, it's roughly around 1%. But the typical or actual use efficacy rate the failure rate is around 8%.
That's because some people forget to take a pill.
Right, all sorts of reasons in terms of that. And so what are the most effective types of birth control are those that are generally removed from the act of intercourse itself, or those things that are not, do not require daily dosing.
So those are the things where they actually put something into your body that ekes out a little bit of chemical on a regular basis?
There are a couple of different types. So certainly anything that would be considered permanent sterilization would fall under that category. So that for women would be occluding the tubes in some manner, or for men, obviously vasectomy. And otherwise, yes, there are things like implants that do have slow release of hormones. There are also injections that can be given every 3 months, and there are also intrauterine devices.
Now, the old traditional birth control pill also worked with the menstrual cycle. Woman would stop using it, she would have her period, and then she'd go back to the pill. But there are others that are continuous use pills. What's the reason for using them?
Well, the way that the pill is designed is that you're right. It's designed to be similar to a woman's natural menstrual cycle. And I think many women feel uncomfortable if they don't have a monthly period.
Some women were even prescribed it, whether they were using it for birth control or not, simply because they had other problems with their menstrual cycles.
Very true. And there are some significant non-contraceptive benefits to the pill that I think are important to highlight. And that is women tend to have lighter periods. They tend to have less cramping. So those are certainly some reasons for which women may be put on the pill for non-contraceptive reasons. But also, women who have used the pill for 1 year or more then have a reduced risk of ovarian cancer by 40 to 50%, and similarly reduced risk of endometrial or uterine cancer by about 40 to 50%.
What about the continuous-use pill? Is it Librel, is it called?
There are a couple of different trade names for it, and it really has to do with the manner in which the pill is marketed, so to speak, because you can use any pill in a continuous fashion. You basically just take the active pills in the last week of the pill pack, which is a placebo pill in general, you can omit. The way that the new pills are marketed, they just don't have that week of placebo pills.
And the reason for having the placebo pills is so that people do not miss a day. They just simply take it every day.
It's a reminder, exactly, so that people can stay in the rhythm of taking a medication every day.
What about the mini pill? How does that work?
So the mini pill is a little bit different in that it is not a combination pill. It has only progesterone.
And what would be the advantage of that?
It's recommended for women who, for some reason or other, should not take estrogen. So for women who have a history of blood clots, women who have a history of liver disease, or women who are nursing, who are breastfeeding, it's been shown that combination pills can suppress the milk supply.
Also prone to certain cancers?
Not so much a risk related to cancer in terms of, there's some controversy about women who've had a history of breast cancer.
Do patches and vaginal rings contain hormones, and do they work in pretty much the same way?
They work very similarly. Both the contraceptive patch and the vaginal ring contain estrogen and progesterone, and their mechanism of action is identical to the oral contraceptive pill.
And then we come to RU486, the so-called morning after pill. That works differently than all these others, doesn't it?
Yes. So RU486, or the morning after pill, is actually a little bit different than what we consider emergency contraception. So RU486 is actually a form of medical abortion. So we use it when women have had a diagnosis or an established pregnancy. Very early on, they can be given mifepristone, which is the name of RU486, and it can be used to induce an abortion. But there is also what we commonly think of as the morning after pill is something called emergency contraception, which is now marketed as Plan B commonly, and which is a higher dose of the same types of hormones that are contained in regular birth control pills, but when they're taken very soon after an act of unprotected intercourse or if a condom breaks, they are very effective at preventing a pregnancy.
So that's different than RU486.
Yes.
And some people find RU486 more of a problem because it really is an abortion pill.
Yes. So ethically, they should, I think, be thought of in different categories.
We have to take a little break here. When we come back, we will take listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guest is Dr. Rini Ratan, Assistant Clinical Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Columbia University Medical Center here in New York. Stay with us. We're back with Dr. Rini Ratan, Assistant Clinical Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Columbia University Medical Center here in New York. And we are taking your calls. And please explain at 212-433-9692. Before we get to those calls, what happens to a woman's eggs over the course of a lifetime if they're not released each month because she's been taking birth control pills?
They just naturally are absorbed into the body, and over time they gradually decrease.
So she would have a menopause at the same time that she would have had if she hadn't been taking the pills?
Yes.
And we know that for a fact?
Yes.
Okay, let's take some calls. 212-433-9692. Rose from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. How do you spell Ratan? Rini Ratan is?
R-A-T-A-N.
Thanks. A friend of mine gains a lot of weight. She takes a shot every couple of months and looks terrible. Can you explain?
She looks terrible in what way?
Very, very overweight, disfigured.
Is it typical for people to put on extra weight when they're taking certain kinds of birth control?
Well, the injection, the injectable type of medication I think that you're referring to, Depo-Provera, is given every 3 months. And it's probably the only method of birth control that does have some association with weight gain.
Uh-huh.
And
do we know why?
Yeah, it increases appetite. It's actually the form.
It's a good reason.
The form of progesterone is actually used in other instances in medicine, specifically as an appetite stimulant.
Rose, has she talked about wanting to eat more?
I don't know her well enough, but I know I see a drastic change, and I'm just curious.
And now you know. Thank you so much for your call. Jennifer from Morristown, Middletown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm 30 years old, and I have been on the pill for 4 years now, and I think I'm probably going to want to stay on it for quite a while. So my question is, are there any negative side effects to being on the pill for, say, over 4 years?
And let me add to that. When the pills first came out, there was a lot of talk about negative side effects. Have they refined the quantities to a point where that's less of a problem?
Yes, I think initially some of the side effects that occurred with the combination pills were related to the estrogen dose.
They just didn't know how much was necessary?
No.
So they gave you more than you probably needed?
Correct. And so over time, we've certainly decreased the estrogen dose that's in the standard pill. There are still a couple of different doses that you can take, but they are all lower than the initial dose that was in the pill. So your question is a great one, and one that patients ask me all the time. And the answer is really no. If you don't have any other contraindications or any other problems to taking the pill, so for example, as long as you don't smoke and you are otherwise healthy and you don't have any other medical problems, women can stay on the pill for many years and do very, very well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your call. Eugene from Huntington, Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard and Dr. Ratan. I'm a male, naturally. I'm a male. And in the middle to late 80s, I had a recurring sinus condition, sinus and middle ear condition, eustachiositis, roughly it was diagnosed as. And I went to see an ear, nose, and throat physician, a specialist, and he prescribed a, what I've come to understand is a birth control, one round of birth control. It came in a flat plastic container and had a number of pills. I don't remember exactly, but it was multiples, perhaps 30, somewhere along those lines.
Well, I get the feeling that I know where you're going, and I get the feeling that Dr. Rattan knows nothing about this, right?
Right.
Is that true?
Sorry.
But is there any reason why estrogen and progesterone would have any effect on sinuses?
Not that I'm aware of.
Why hasn't a birth control pill, there's been so much talk about it, why hasn't one been developed for men?
Well, there are still some that are kind of in the process or in the works under development. There are a couple of problems in terms of how to administer testosterone. It is difficult in the route of administration. Sometimes it has to be given in injections or other patches, and the dosage can be inconsistent. So that's one issue. The other problem kind of inherent to male contraceptives is that it takes a number of months before the sperm count is completely reduced. So even with the vasectomy, there is a lag time of about 3 months or so before the sperm that were already in the testes before you occlude the vas deferens are no longer viable. So there is always a little bit of a lag time, which inherently can pose a problem.
I heard years ago, maybe it was just something that somebody wanted to believe, that there was a side effect to the chemicals they'd come up with, and that if a man took one drink, he got absolutely blotto. And some people said, well, hey, gee, I would take the pill for that reason alone. We go now to Randy from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've anecdotally observed two things that I'd love an expert to weigh in on. One is that when ovulating, there are some PMS symptoms, not just mood, but aches, backache and headache that occur when not on a pill. And I think I've noticed mood changes happen even when on the pill, and I've been poo-pooed as that can't be because there's no ovulation. How can there be ovulation symptoms? And the other thing I've noticed is that not only can a woman become irritable, but I suspect that the people around them can become more of an irritant. I think my kids actually might, through pheromones or some other action, respond and become... have something happen that doesn't, it's not exactly PMS, but I noticed that the bickering doesn't always start from the mother, if that makes any sense.
Do you know anything about this?
Well, I think that there definitely are symptoms that can be associated, PMS symptoms that can happen definitely when women are not on the pill. And it's very individual in terms of how women respond emotionally when they're on the pill. There are some women who find that the pill is kind of an emotional stabilizer and their mood is very constant. Other women find that they cry, they're very teary. Other women find that they are, their emotions are much more labile. So I don't think we can say yet that there is a particular formulation or particular type of pill that predisposes to any one of those, but it is a very individual response that women have.
Thank you for your call. Dorothy from Chelsea, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was interested in what you had to say about the effect of taking the pill for a year reducing certain kinds of cancer. And I'm wondering if that's a lifetime effect or whether it's short-term.
It is a lifetime effect. And it always puzzles me a little bit why this is not more well-known, because it's a fantastic benefit that women get when they take the pill after a year's of use, and it really is a dramatic decrease in both the risk of ovarian and uterine cancer.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. That's great news.
Thank you. Nancy from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that about vaccines that have been given out to girls about 11 years old before they're sexually active. I wanted to find out what the controversy is and how does it prevent cancer in years to come.
Well, the vaccine that's being given now is a vaccine that's directed against human papillomavirus, and particularly four strains of it. And it's been well shown that the human papillomavirus is responsible for probably about 70% of cervical cancer cases. And the human papillomavirus has many different subtypes, and it's extraordinarily common in the population. So women, once they have sexual contact, are at very high risk of contracting at least one of the subtypes. So the idea behind the vaccine is, if you vaccinate young girls or adolescent women before they initiate sexual activity, you will essentially protect them from contracting those subtypes of HPV and therefore dramatically reduce their risk of getting cervical cancer later in life.
I've read that there are some spermicides containing a substance called ninoxinol 9, which may actually increase the chances of being infected with human papillomavirus. You say it easily, more easily than I do. Is that right?
Well, ninoxinol 9 initially was designed as a spermicide, and we were very hopeful that it would also have a viricidal effect and that it would be helpful against preventing things like sexually transmitted infections such as HIV. Unfortunately, that part of it has not borne out, and there have been studies that showing that there's no decrease in transmission rates of gonorrhea, chlamydia, or HIV. There is a possibility that actually ninoxinol 9 can cause a little bit of vaginal irritation, and that may actually increase the likelihood of transmitting certain viruses.
My guest is Dr. Rini Banerjee-Rattan, who's an assistant clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. We're talking about the chemistry of birth control on today's Please Explain, and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. John, who has just pulled over on the New York Thruway. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, taking the call. Doctor, we constantly hear about people claiming the reliability of the different kinds of birth control. You know, 90% for this one, 99% for that one. And I think that number gets misused because people, from what I learned in school, it was a statistic that had to do with 100 women taking this contraceptive for a year, and like 1% of them would come up pregnant, as opposed to you're taking a 10% risk each time or 1% each time. Could you explain what those reliability numbers mean?
Sure. So with almost all the birth control methods, there is a difference in terms of what we call the perfect use or the typical use. And so perfect use means that a woman and her partner use whatever method it is exactly as prescribed. Let's use the pill, for example, that the woman takes the pill every day at exactly the same time, never misses a pill, never misses the timing of a pill, and initiates the pill on the right time in her menstrual cycle, and so on and so forth. That's what we would consider to be perfect use. And in that case, for example, with the pill, the failure rate is about less than 1%. In typical use or in actual use, we know that life intervenes and people don't take their pill at the same time every day, and that people do miss pills, and that the prescription runs out and people miss a day or whatever it might be. And in actual use, for almost every method of birth control, the failure rate is much higher. So with the pill, the actual use failure rate is for around 8%.
A listener sent us an email, and the question is, I'm always curious how long it's safe to be on the pill if I eventually want to have a baby. And if 1 year reduces your risk of certain cancers, how much longer is recommended for continued pill use then?
So the benefit has not shown to be that it's dose-related, so to speak, meaning that if you stay on the pill longer, you probably don't get any more further reduction, unfortunately. But already that's a great reduction. In terms of the effect on future fertility, there, again, it's not related to how long you've been on the pill. So if you've been on the pill for 5 years, it doesn't mean that you have a lower likelihood of being able to get pregnant when you come off of it.
So immediately, if you stop taking the pill, there's a chance you could become pregnant?
Yes, there's a very short delay in return to fertility with the birth control pill, although again, with each method, there can be variation in terms of delay to fertility. Some of the injectable methods that we talked about previously, because they are injected into the muscle and they stay in the body and release the hormone at a slow rate, they can take up to 6 months or a year before women are actually ovulating again.
Jennifer from Middletown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I am currently pregnant with our second child, but okay. My husband and I feel like we might not want to have any more, but neither want to take permanent measures to prevent that. And I had been on the pill. I was taking Orthonovum 777, and everything was fine. I didn't have a problem. It seemed to do its job. But I don't think I want to go back on the pill. So I was wondering about the IUDs.
Let me expand that. What are the benefits and the positives and the negatives about IUD, about a diaphragm, which seems to be losing popularity, and the cervical cap, which we used to hear an awful lot about in the past, but I think I haven't heard anything about it in years.
Sure. First of all, congratulations. That's very exciting. I think that the IUD is a fantastic method of birth control, and again, is underutilized in the United States.
How does it work? It's put in the cervix?
Yes. Well, it's put into the uterus. So it is extremely effective. The failure rate is less than 1%. And as Jennifer mentioned, it is reversible. So for some reason, in a few years, change your mind and decide you want to have another baby, you come back into the office, pull the IUD out, and there's no delay in return to fertility, just, you know, whatever the normal menstrual cycle is. It can be inserted in the office. It's really a very easy procedure. And the key with the IUD is the person has to be a good candidate. So somebody has to be in a monogamous relationship with one partner. The reason for that is that if somebody is in a point in her life where she has more than one partner, that in and of itself increases the risk for sexually transmitted infections. And in that case, if you have an indwelling object in your uterus, that increases the chance for infection and that infection to rise into the pelvic organs. So in somebody who has one partner and desires long-term contraception, the IUD can stay in up to 10 years. It's, as I said, very effective. It has very, very few side effects. There are two types of IUDs, one that doesn't contain hormones and one that does contain progesterone. In women who take the IUD which doesn't contain hormones, there are obviously no side effects related to any hormonal effect. Women will notice often that their period is a little bit heavy, heavier than in the past, but that's really about it. Women, they don't know it's there. Your partner doesn't feel it.
And the other two you have to put in every time, and so that becomes a problem.
The diaphragm has a few problems. It still has its role because it is a barrier, so it does offer some protection, although less than a condom in terms of preventing sexually transmitted infections. A nice thing about the diaphragm is that it is in the woman's control, so she can place it in. You can place a diaphragm before intercourse, so it's not interruptive, so to speak. But the diaphragm doesn't have as high efficacy rate. Its failure rate is probably in the 15% range. And there can be some association with urinary tract infections.
Let's go to Ariana from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question. What is her opinion of women who don't get their period for long periods of time and if that can be natural or if the birth control pill should be used?
So women who don't get their period for, you're speaking about somebody who doesn't get their period and is not on any birth control?
Right.
Yeah, that definitely can be indicative of a problem and should certainly be evaluated.
And a listener wrote about getting off the birth control and going bald. Could there be any link between the two, or would that perhaps be caused by something else?
It's unlikely to be caused by that.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. I'm sorry we couldn't get to more of the calls, but this is obviously something we should do a follow-up on. My guest has been Dr. Rini Banerjee-Rattan, Assistant Clinical Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Columbia University Medical Center here in New York. And If people want to know more about this, are there any websites they can go to?
There are a couple of websites. Planned Parenthood has a great great website on contraception. And then the American College of OBGYN has a lot of patient information as well.
Thank you again for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In the wake of the release of hundreds of top secret documents, on Monday's show we reveal some of the darker moments in the CIA's troubled past. Then an outbreak in 1974 of 148 tornadoes that killed more than 300 people and caused damage throughout 13 states. Also a new novel set in 17th century China, and two-time Academy Award winner Milos Forman with his latest movie about Spain during the time of Francisco Goya. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Nishik. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Bridget Bergen, Barbara Kahn, Julia Corcoran, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Jay Cout was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.